Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Shad here, your hosts for this weekend's edition. Also your hosts throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report. Big shout out to Shad throughout this last week as I was away for spring break with my family. So Shad took all the heavy lifting when it came to more news and more volatility, especially around that Fed meeting and statement. Because we've talked so much, at least in the last few weeks, about the banking sector, the Fed, just what might happen in terms of short-term market moves, I really think it's valuable to take a step back and look at big picture what has been going on with the economy, with some of the markets. We are also, though, going to touch on the banking sector. We are kicking off the show with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Financial Group, also editor of the Book Report website. That's where you can keep up to date with Peter in terms of market data, market moves, and anything else that's catching his eye, all geared towards the investor. Peter, I do want to get your thoughts on the at least initial failure of some smaller banks, except for that Silicon Valley Bank, as well as the Fed, the government, other governments also stepping into the banking sector to help shore up depositors, making them whole. When we take a step back from this, Peter, just how big of an issue are these cracks in the system for the banking system around the world?
Well, for U.S. banks, obviously mostly the regionals, you know, we're talking more about what the equity value is going to be for some of them. They need to raise capital, equity capital, and what the lending environment is going to be like. I don't expect really any more, or I should say many more, SVBs or signature banks where you have outright failure. Now, there is a question now that's very open-ended about whether uninsured deposits will be insured and it'll be just a blanket government coverage, you know, putting aside the philosophical debate whether that's the right thing to do or not. We're sort of in this gray area. And until that is answered by Congress, I think there's obviously going to be a lot of questions being asked. But I think it's less going to be the viability of these most of these banks and more so the hit to profitability via higher deposit rates, shrinking loan margins, thus less loan growth, and at the same time, as I said, equity raises to firm up one's balance sheet. So there is economic consequences to slow down in lending, and there's going to be an equity consequence for those that need to raise capital that way. Broadly speaking, you say global, to elaborate, you know, with Europe, for example, who they had a big sell-off in bank equity as well, sort of in sympathy. But I think there's less of an acute issue in Europe. But at the same time, 80% of the lending to business, both big and small in Europe, is done via the banks. So if they continue to tighten, and I say continue because they already started it, and the same is in the case in the U.S., there's been a tightening of lending standards, which you can only imagine is going to accelerate. So Europe's economy is at risk just from a slowdown in lending, and the U.S. economy will be negatively impacted as well. At the same time, we were already on the cusp of, you know, an economic downturn in response to the aggressive rate hikes.
Well, Peter, just in the along those lines that we were already setting up for some kind of a pullback or slowdown or contraction in the economy because of these aggressive rate hikes, and even if they were to pause the Federal Reserve and even other central banks and leave these rates higher, we still don't know what the overall effects are going to be. But in lieu of some of these banks holding bonds that they bought when they were a lot lower interest rate environment, and these rate hikes have caused interest rates to have got, you know, the yield curve got inverted, the 10-year, the 2-year, everything shot up so high so quick that a lot of them were sitting on problem assets when people pulled their deposits out. And that's really where some of these banking issues came from. People are drawing an analogy to the 2008 great financial crisis, but they seem a little different because that was about toxic debt and about, you know, mortgage-backed securities that really weren't worth anything. How would you compare this to the 2008-2009 Great Financial Crisis?
Well, I think that's right. That's where there's a huge difference, is that banks were loaded up on crappy assets, where right now the problem is more of risk-free assets of held to maturity, but duration marks that look ugly. You know, the irony is that the Fed probably has the most ugliest balance sheet, with about half the bonds that they own north of 10 years in maturity. But putting that aside, that is the challenge that these banks make. But, you know, the strange thing is that that's what banks do. They borrow short, they lend long. And they lend long in a variety of different ways, whether they're buying agency MBS, U.S. Treasuries, or they're lending money to a business. So there's always an asset liability mismatch that takes place at banks. The question is, of course, to what extent and what those assets are in. But, you know, in the banking regime that we have and the accounting standards we have and differentiating between hold to maturity and available for sale, and also just the confidence of one's depositors all come together in this sort of strange mix. We know that SVB was sort of unique in that it had a very concentrated deposit base and focused on really one industry, and that's what screwed them. I think broadly speaking, the rest of the banking sector has much more diversified deposits. So hopefully that there'll be a sense of calm that kicks in after the troubled ones figure it out one way or the other. And we can just go back to focusing on what the, you know, again, the profit standpoint, as I said, the impact is rather than the viability is of these.
So I want to circle around to something that you said, because it seems to be the consensus here is that lending is going to slow down, if not grind to a halt. How important is that to understand for investors in terms of where money will flow then? If lending is unavailable to these growth companies, do they have any hope?
Well, lending still might be available to some extent, but it just may be at, you know, a much higher cost. And when you think about, if you're in commercial real estate, a lot of these banks already have a lot of commercial real estate loans on their books. So they've been loath to further expand that business. They're just trying to figure out the legacy loans that they have. So at least that area, you're going to have to go to non-bank lenders in order to get loans in commercial real estate, but you're going to have to pay up for it. And there are going to be projects that don't take up, that don't get off the ground because the numbers don't work anymore, or you're going to have to pump up more equity. It's just the broad impact is going to be a slowing pace of activity. And those with strong balance sheets and liquidity are going to have a field day taking advantage of this.
So when we take this all into account, especially with the slowdown in lending, with the issues in the banking system, and with investors getting a little bit more defensive, is this all deflationary then in your eyes here, Peter? I know the Fed has wanted a disinflation environment, but does this all lead to deflation?
Well, maybe sooner, or I should say immediately, as the economy slows, but you know, we continue to have these bailouts. The Fed continues to, you know, has turned on the sort of liquidity spigot here as their balance sheet in 1 week got back to the highest level since last November. So it could be, but I think with the inflation debate, it's where it settles out at after this rate hiking cycle plays through. And if the Fed eventually responds by, you know, cutting interest rates and we can see a reacceleration in any downward trend on inflation. I think structurally speaking, the level of inflation is going to be higher. But yeah, in the next 6 months, can we get further fall in prices because the economy is further weakening? Yeah. But you know, to me, that would just be temporary disinflation rather than anything else.
Peter, you brought up an interesting point there about the Fed's balance sheet, because they have been on the tightening warpath for some time now. And they were really big on quantitative tightening and starting to, you know, shore up some of their balance sheet. But over the last few weeks, as they've backstopped some of these banks and have a facility available that could even further fund these banks, they've wiped out a lot of that tightening that they've done all in one motion here. What kind of effect do you think that's going to have on the economy and on the marketplace?
Well, I don't think much on the economy and the markets. I think that money is being raised by banks in return for handing over their agency and treasuries. First of all, it's only a one-year term. And I think these banks are just doing it to just satisfy any deposits that leave. This money is not going to be lent out at the businesses because it's going to have to be returned in a year. So I think this money is just sort of pull the lever if there's an emergency. That's what this is. So yeah, optically, the balance sheet's expanding again. But again, this money is, at least as of now, is going to have to be returned during a year. And I think it's just insurance money and to fill holes, deposit holes that may come up.
Well, Peter, over the last couple of years, we've talked a lot with a lot of our guests about the rotation from sector to sector. And we've seen from 2020 to 2021, where growth was reigning supreme, a lot of that money in 2022 shifted over to the value sector, where you saw more of an investment in utilities, consumer staples, healthcare. The financials were part of that, although I'm not sure how stable those are now. But even some of the commodities got a bit in energy. Now we're kind of seeing a bifurcated market where over the last couple of weeks, we've seen things kind of breaking some of those correlations. You know, we've seen some of the safe haven assets get more of a bid, a kind of a breakdown in energy. But even within the general equities, certain areas are doing well while others are not. How do you make sense of this, where we've kind of seen this overall rotation from one to the other into more of a choppy, kind of fragmented market now?
Well, in a way, it's been going on for a while. I mean, if you look back almost a year ago, the S&P 500, to use that as an example, has traded as high as 4,300 and down in around 3,600. Well, the 50% retracement of that is about 3,950. So that's what we've been doing for the last year, is just churning and churning and chopping and chopping and having this rotational type activity. Where last year the trade was to buy energy, sell tech. Recently it's sell energy and buy tech. So that's just a characteristic of markets for a while. I still think the overall trend for many of these groups or some of these groups will be lower, but sort of tight time frames, you know, you get these algorithmic rotations that tend to be violent at times.
So, Peter, you mentioned energy and last year how the trade was out of tech into energy, at least for the first half of the year. Let's talk commodities, but let's start with energy again. Do you see the health of, let's say, oil or natural gas still sticking around? Or are you thinking that maybe those will drop along with as everything else slows down?
Well, we've certainly seen a sharp pullback already as the optimism about a demand increase from China has been offset by worries about a recession in the U.S. and slowdown in Europe. So it's sort of this tug of war. I still think over the coming years, oil prices are going to go much higher, but I certainly have to respect the concerns about a faltering in U.S. demand for sure. I still think that you know, over the coming year, China's increase in demand will overwhelm that. But yeah, I understand the pullback, but I still think that the sector is pretty attractive, as are the stocks.
Well, let's also talk about the precious metals. Over the last couple of weeks, they have garnered a bid in light of some of the flight to safe haven, along with bonds and with the yen. So just curious what your take is on how the precious metals are setting up for the balance of this year.
Well, when you think about the two biggest points of bearishness over the past year, is the Fed's so aggressive in raising interest rates and the dollar's been strong. Well, the Fed is about done raising interest rates, and the dollar peaked last September and is now rolling over. And of course, now you have Fed's balance sheet increasing and what that means for potentially the dollar, what rising U.S. debts and deficits mean as a headwind for the dollar. And I think this, and I've said this before, so I'm guilty of being wrong in terms of my timing, but this is the kind of environment that that gold and silver could thrive.
What are your thoughts on these critical minerals? Because boy, oh boy, they're in the news a lot. Government seem more supportive of them, even shoring up big pools of capital for them. We've even seen on our site generally more interest in these sort of, and they're not new metals, but they do have this new interest in them. Do you think that this is a sustainable trend, that these critical minerals are truly in a bull market and money will stay available for them?
Well, I think all we have to do is look at the government's goals for EV usage and other renewables and the closure of coal plants and so on and so on. And that it's an impossible dream to be realized unless we get our hands on a lot of these materials. So I see for sure a lot of money that's going to be invested in whether it's lithium or copper or cobalt or nickel and other things that are going to be needed to power this new sort of, you know, energy utopian world that many want us to accelerate to.
Well, based on those comments, Peter, are you seeing the commodities in general as still part of a larger uptrend? Or do you think a lot of the move we saw in 2022 got overly exaggerated due to the Ukraine war? I mean, what's your outlook, I guess, more in the medium to longer term for the commodity sector, barring some short-term volatility?
No, I still think that the trend is up. I still think that there's major supply challenges for a bunch of these different metals, some more than others. Demand is going to be temporarily impacted by a slowdown in the economy for sure. But when looking out over 5 to 10 years, there still seems to be a big mismatch between the demand that is needed relative to the supply that can be found.
Then are you interested in sticking to the larger commodity markets because they are more established? Or do you like these growing commodity markets because of the potential increase percentage-wise in demand?
I mean, I'm sticking to some of the bigger ones, you know, whether that's copper or nickel, that I think is are two really attractive industrial metals in particular. But, you know, it's as we know, the mining's a tough business, and a lot of the mines were in not the most hospitable places, and you have to you know, weather a bunch of price volatility, particularly what we're seeing now.
Well, just maybe one more on the commodities that kind of ties more into the energy side, Peter, and that is that we, you know, we give a lot of time to oil and nat gas, and rightly so, it's a huge market. But there's other aspects of the energy sector like nuclear for uranium or the renewable sector with solar and wind and hydro. And you still have nat gas as being an important component with nat gas plants if you're converting coal plants. Is there any area of the energy sector that you're more bullish on than other aspects, or what's your take as the overall energy picture?
I'm pretty bullish on uranium. I've been for years and I remain so. Nuclear certainly is getting a lot deserved respect, as it should, in light of everything that's gone on over the past year plus. And I still think that there's a major supply-demand imbalance over the next 5 to 10 years in uranium. And I'm bullish and we're long.
Okay. Peter, I guess final comments then. Big picture, what matters for the rest of this year? Is it economic data? Is it the banking sector? Is it what central banks do? How are you going to balance out everything for the remainder of this year, which is quite a long time?
Well, it's all of the above, because we're living in a higher cost of capital world that just got even higher in light of what's going on with the banks. And in a credit-dependent, interest rate-dependent economy, this just naturally is going to slow the demand for borrowing, will slow the supply from lenders, and you're going to see slower economic growth until this economy can build up greater savings, both at the household side and the business side, that can rely more on equity than debt.
Okay, Peter, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts here. Again, kind of taking a step back from all this day-to-day action that we get bogged down with. There are some big picture themes that have really come to light in the last year and a quarter, let's call it, that do need to get noted because it is, quite frankly, a very different market environment. Peter, thank you as always for your time. If you want to keep up to date on what Peter's following, what he's writing about, you need to check out the book report, which I will link to in the weekend show posting. Peter, thanks again for your time.
Thank you, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Now the second half of this weekend's edition, we are going to be shifting our focus a bit more for all those investors in the gold stocks as we are chatting with Tavi Costa, portfolio manager at Crescat Capital. Now, Tavi, I want to take more a big picture look to give everybody some insights on what Crescat is looking for in terms of investments, either red flags that would turn you away from them or the type of companies as well that you find that you really are specializing in more with a big picture outlook. Let's start with jurisdictions. A lot of people talk about tier one jurisdictions, but quite frankly, you can find companies in almost every country, it seems like. And sometimes countries get hot, sometimes they don't. Sometimes broad continents are largely avoided outside of just the simple tier one jurisdictions that everyone says, oh, you want to have a world-class deposit in a tier one jurisdiction. That's more or less obvious. What about filtering down to other jurisdictions? Which ones, Tavi, do you think have a good opportunity here? Which ones do you guys like that aren't just that mainstream tier one jurisdiction?
And I think it helps to have a macro framework to think about this question, and something that we've been obviously doing a lot at Crescat, which is when you have a view that we're entering a period of the next decade that is likely to be inflationary. By that, I mean just that inflation will run in average for the overall decade higher than prior decades, and you have cost of capital being higher as well. It's hard not to favor commodities over other things. And we know how most capital allocators have been really under allocating their own capital into tangible assets as a whole. And our view is very strong that we're seeing this deglobalization trends intensifying and looking for places in the world that will sort of benefit from this rather than the other way around. Like China, for instance, may not benefit from this. Is very important. And when you think about emerging markets are, in my opinion, in a very different stance. You have the net importers like China and India, and then you have geopolitical mess countries like Russia or China as well. And so Brazil is a place that actually falls into a different category of those. It's almost like any other most parts of the South American continent, which is very interesting because I think those economies will actually serve the world in a very different way and create different partnerships that we've had over the past years that are mostly served by places like China in the past and Russia as well. And so we think that when you look at the valuation of most of assets in South America, particularly Brazil, and we also have a strong view about Bolivia and other places that are becoming better, such as Chile, perhaps. And there are some negative sides of South America as well. But we're starting to become more and more bullish in that whole area just because of those macro reasons. And looking for opportunities there is fascinating because, yes, it requires everything has a price, right? I mean, the risk you're taking needs to be reflected in the price of the asset that you are buying. Therefore, that is certainly the case in some of the assets we've been buying in those areas. Those are also places that have been extremely unexplored. And some of those economies are looking to open up in order to attract more capital from institutions like ourselves. And so we're very glad to be in this position to be deploying capital in some of those areas. Brazil is and Bolivia are certainly my favorite, knowing that there is still risk for a lot of things. The political environment in Brazil has changed over the last year or so with the change in political leadership as well. However, when you think about the overall, the underlying thesis behind this is kind of sort of being masked by those issues. And that is mostly because, in my opinion, the economy itself, which is very natural resource rich, is not only extremely correlated to the commodity market, but also when you think about a commodity person or a fund looking to find exposure to commodities is a very relatively small place. And so it's hard to spread your wing and diversify into different parts of the world. And so it's just hard to believe the South American economies won't serve as an alternative. And some places like Brazil might play even a bigger role than others. And some others like Bolivia have that carry a larger risk, but also have you know, great opportunities when it comes to quality of assets as well. So, you know, as I said earlier, everything needs to have its appropriate price as well, relative to the risk you're carrying in those areas. But I do believe that I think market is perceiving this as a much higher risk than what actually is. And considering the last 10 years as a factor, which I don't think will be the same. I think those markets are actually likely to outperform developed economies and do much better over the next decade or so.
Well, Tavi, I think this is a really interesting topic for investors to consider jurisdiction, because when you think about what Corey mentioned, the tier one jurisdictions, let's say Nevada or Idaho in the United States, or Quebec or British Columbia in Canada, a lot of people pile into those, but often those companies trade at a big premium to other companies as a result of people feeling like they're safer. But when you look at South American countries, the risk some people see is the political side and how that may affect taxation. So when you look at things like the direction Chile or Peru has gone, or Ecuador has kind of been a revolving door of good cycles and bad cycles, there's countries that were considered previously fantastic, like Peru or Chile, that have been under more pressure with investors. And then other countries like Argentina or Bolivia that you mentioned that were in the hurt locker, and they've actually improved, but they often trade at a dramatic discount, especially companies that have developed some resources or, you know, have some exciting drilling that's proven there's proof in the pudding. Those companies usually trade at a big discount, similar to how West African countries traded a big discount to, let's say, North American companies. Is that where you see an arbitrage of value, where it's unrealized how valuable these projects are because they're trading at a discount? Or how do you discount tougher jurisdictions when you're taking an investment stake in them?
We're very conservative when it comes to that. I mean, as you guys know, we'd like to build models and to be as unbiased as we can in our decisions. And so we put into consideration what's the size of the asset that we're dealing with, grades that are likely to be delivered. Obviously, those are huge variables that can change over time and be improved as our accuracy and our more information comes along. But in terms of political risk, I think there's a long-term and a short-term cycle for things. The long-term cycle is very bullish for South America, meaning all the things I said that favor commodities and also favor a place that is very neutral, geopolitically speaking. I mean, very few economies even entered the World War II, you know, in terms of being involved with those. Brazil is a great example. It's almost like the Switzerland of South America when it comes to doing businesses with China, doing businesses with Russia, and doing businesses with Europe and other places in Europe, and also in other places in like the US or Canada or Australia. It doesn't really care of who you are. It just wants to make money. And so that's sort of the long-term cycle that I think it's turning. It hasn't fully turned yet, but it's turning. And it will be turning as you see this sort of commodity market becoming stronger and stronger over time, and requiring more and more capital over time as well, will slowly transition into making South America a great opportunity. The short-term cycle is a little bit different, is when you have, you know, a political leadership change, which happens in most places every 4 years. And once you have those, let's say in Brazil, the initial reaction can be a little bit negative. Now, majority of those presidents, especially if they have an agenda that is against exploring and developing and producing natural resources, which tends to be the case in most left-wing parties in those places. And remember, left-wing parties in South America are significantly more extreme than left-wing parties in the U.S. It's almost like the left-wing in the U.S. is supposedly a right-wing in South America. Sort of a joke, but true. And you can see this by looking at their agendas as well, that is quite similar to some of the Democratic parties here in the U.S. relative to what the right-wing agenda is in Brazil, for instance. But the point being, usually the first few years or so, you know, they tend to take a strong stance until they realize that's where the money comes from. It's from natural resources. And usually you see it ease up from those regulations, and things tend to get better. I mean, there are cases where things go truly south, like you saw with Venezuela, but that was, again, on the back of a long-term cycle that was not very favorable. This was a time while commodities were not in a very good environment. I mean, we had oil prices collapsing many times over the last decade or so, and it was very difficult for that place to be surviving on the back of oil prices. And certainly, I think that that kind of also feeding the political turmoil that we've had over those years. Same goes to Argentina as well. But there are parts of South America that are improving, parts of South America that are starting to see this influx of capital. And, you know, I think there are pockets of value. There, not everything is value in South America. Not everything is supposedly an arbitrage or major value attractive opportunity. But yeah, I think Brazil, Bolivia, some parts of Peru, some parts of Mexico, even, and some other regions are quite attractive. And so we are selective. It all depends on the uniqueness of the project itself and the quality of it as well. The prices are being sold, who is running the show. That is even more relevant in places like South America, their connections and capabilities of getting permits and so forth. And in some parts like Bolivia, for instance, you can get likely your permits and even mines being developed much quicker than places like North America, for instance, which is a surprise for a lot of people. We are working with different projects in Bolivia, which we think we can put into production in a much quicker manner than other projects would be done in places like Nevada or like you mentioned in Canada as well. So yeah, I think it's an attractive opportunity, but that's just my opinion.
So Tavi, let's kind of combine this topic then with a few other big themes that investors look for. So when you're looking in some of these other jurisdictions, not so much tier one jurisdictions, how important is it, one, that there are larger companies working and successfully operating in those areas? Because that ties into that whole concept of nobody actually wants to build an asset. They just want to sell it. They want to drill and sell it and get out. How important are both of those factors when you're looking at companies? One being operating companies in the jurisdiction, and two, that whole strategy of simply selling an asset, not developing it.
Well, it's such a big question because the notion I have, at least, is that everyone in this market, particularly in exploration, is a seller. And I'm referring to the CEOs of those companies. And maybe this is a function of the bear market and the depressed market we've had over the years and all the issues we've had with this industry that is causing most of those CEOs to be happy with potentially selling their assets for 2 to 3x of what they pay for, knowing that, you know, or ignoring the fact perhaps that the potential for those assets, if they are developed and taken into production one day, which I know it's a long-term plan, would likely unleash a much larger value for the investors. And so I think this is creating a setup for someone to be very creative, someone who has access for capital that is able to enter the space and able to acquire most of those high quality exploration names and take them into production. I'm not saying Crescent has necessarily the goal of being that, but we're certainly open for the idea, which I think it's almost being presented to us at this point, given the fact that what I thought it would happen a while ago, which is the supply cliff issue with most of the major companies are facing, that the M&A activity would be heating up much quicker. But we haven't seen much of that. Yes, I should point out that our core investments that we have at Crescent, meaning the companies that have recently defined that they do have a significant amount of resources and are on track to become major discoveries over time, are certainly now in engagement with the major companies, which to me, this is a new theme. We haven't really seen this in early 2022, for instance. I would say in the last 4 to 5 months, things have really heat up in that front. We even had an example of a company recently with it, which is Snowline Gold, that got an investment from B2 Gold. And so, but this is happening across most of the, or, you know, I would say our key investments. It's interesting as well, but I'm not sure that opportunity even is larger to be selling those assets to the majors at the prices that we're seeing. It's probably a much better opportunity for someone that has access to cash flow to be, you know, really bulking up those assets and making a large major company again. That's how major companies get developed over time. But we haven't seen anybody with that type of vision being able to create those. And yes, this is at the same time bullish for metals itself, because we know that if that's not happening anytime soon, supply will also remain constrained for the longer period of time. But at the same time, it's creating an incredible opportunity. Like I said, I'm not saying Crescent will be doing that. We are starting to create vehicles that will create cash flow to allow us to make those moves. But I think this opportunity literally is being presented to us, and it's just hard to ignore. And if it's not us, I think someone is going to be doing that at some point. But it's just amazing to talk to folks and speak with CEOs of the companies that we are investors. And the sentiment when it comes to what would you like to do with this company 5 to 10 years from now, and the overwhelming answer that we get is always that they would like to sell it to a major at, you know, call it 2 to 3x the value that is currently, or maybe 5x the value it's currently. But that's not how Ross Beaty became a billionaire. That's not how most of those guys became, or the billionaires of the industry made really their money. It was through developing, not only finding those major discoveries, but really developing new major companies that on the back of those became, a large percentage of their wealth. And so to me, this is where perhaps the real opportunity is. And it starts from the macro framework, as I said earlier, because to me, metals and mining, almost more than any other part of the commodity space, is what looks extremely attractive, not only from a fundamental perspective, but also from the side of what things are likely to happen with the revitalization of manufacturing plants in the G7 economies, with the fact that we do have those inflationary forces that are likely to cause investors to look for exposure to metals. The Green Revolution is going to play a role into this. Central banks having to buy gold to improve the quality of their international reserves. I can't think of a better time to be starting to bulk up, you know, especially those high quality assets that we have in exploration part of the industry than right now, because it's everything is cheap and nobody's really willing to take that risk.
Well, Tavi, you bring up a great point there. And yeah, Ross Beaty built up his wealth by rolling things up into Pan American Silver when nobody wanted to develop these assets and put a lot of projects into one company. Keith Neumeyer did that with First Majestic. You could argue that Ross Beaty's doing it again with Equinox Gold by rolling up a lot of other projects that were stalled into one larger company with that cash flow to really acquire good quality assets and put them into production. But don't you think that if you look at the sector, a lot of the reason that most of these exploration companies don't want to hold for the long term 5 to 10 years and put it in production is they don't have those skill sets. They are geologists and explorers. They don't really have experience even in the development side and in the construction side, much less bringing a mine in production. And we have watched a series of belly flops into the swimming pool for the last few years from companies that thought they could take a small mine or a medium-sized mine and put it in production. And over again, those companies failed, never got off the mat. So there's a lot of companies watching that cycle play out and say, hey, I don't want to try to take with the team I have, or even if I bring on a new team, this project into production, I'd rather just sell it to somebody else. Isn't that why so many companies have that as their exit strategy?
Absolutely. I mean, by no means I'm saying this is an easy path. There's a reason there's one Ross Beaty out there and not 50 of those guys swimming around. And so it's not the easy path at all. I mean, the easy path is to identify perhaps you're at the early stages of a bull market for metals and mining industries and acquire a high quality exploration asset. That's the majority of the strategies across most of those CEOs. By doing that, you know, trying to get a foundation of good capital to really fund those stories at their early stages, develop those stories over time, get a hot market, sell that to the majors in an M&A cycle. Well, that's, you know, in a way, that's not an easy strategy either to accomplish. However, I think it requires what's happening currently, which what you pointed out is just not just a capital trend of lack of investments in the commodity space really is a labor trend, right? It's the fact that we had a, you know, if you look at the enrollments for geosciences in most universities today, it's also at a secular downward trend as well, which means the interest for folks to become geologists in geosciences is just not there. And so who is going to create the next new projects and so forth? But there are some very high quality folks that you can create companies with that have the capability and ability as well to create those over time. And so I'm a believer that you certainly can create those new major companies. It's just the vision is just so far away from everyone just because we haven't seen any of that happen in the last decades. And so the risk seems far higher than what the premium should be in order to do that. And so, but all you need is a changing that in that tune where you start seeing one or two names and folks becoming successful in creating those new opportunities that certainly will attract more folks doing the same. I mean, we've taken an approach that is in a way similar to the venture capital approach, as I said before in other interviews, which has been to deploy large amounts of, at least for us, of capital in a very diversified way. And, you know, getting 10 to 20% stake in high quality companies with, you know, what we think are worth multiples of what they are worth currently. And then, you know, either wait for the majors to take them out or ourselves can maybe find a way to put them into production or roll them up, as you said, like Russ Beatty did. But, you know, I think there's many ways to skin the cat. And I think not necessarily I'm saying that Crescat will follow that path, but it's, you know, Newmont started that way early in the days. That's, you know, it was an investment fund that used to take stakes and interest in different great projects across the world. They had major discoveries, and over time they became what they became. And so I think that there's one potential path for us in addition to what we do in the macro side. And we're certainly looking at those opportunities and seeing if they fit of our strategy. But I think it's all becoming more and more suitable to what the macro environment really is. And it amazes me of, you know, if you look at my conviction, at least, I mean, I don't care about other people's convictions, but my conviction, at least on the macro reasons for you to be investing in the space have never been higher. I mean, my learning curve over the last 1 to 2 to 3 years has been, you know, exponentially higher. And I still think I need to learn a lot more about this industry like everybody else, but I still think that this is an incredible opportunity that everyone is ignoring. And, you know, if there is room for someone to be creative here, I think that that would be ideal for us to do that.
Hey, Tavi, it'd be great to see some more profitable mines built, some more companies that actually grow into some of the majors or significant mid-tiers that carry some weight, because that could actually free up some more funding for the sector. That's one of the biggest issues within this sector, is that funding has been hard to come by. Crescat has come in, and you guys have put a lot of money at work, but quite frankly, there just aren't that many new groups that have entered the sector to provide capital to exploration companies, or even to provide capital to some of the already producing companies. So that's one thing that has definitely held back this sector. We are out of time, but look, I think we can carry this over next time we chat into some of the exploration companies and flaws that you see with those strategies. So next month, we're going to have you back on, and let's more focus on some of the exploration plays and what you guys like to see in terms of what companies are doing on the drilling front. Everybody, thanks for tuning in. This wraps up this weekend show, and we'll be back with you next week. As always, please keep in touch with Shad and myself through email. Tavi, everyone else, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for taking your time with us this weekend. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.